Welcome to the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. Each episode, the CREXI team dives into a broad range of topics to investigate trends, educate listeners, and understand the latest industry news. As the nation's fastest growing online CRE platform, we're excited to provide a window into the inner workings of commercial real estate for this generation and the next.
Welcome, and thank you all for joining us for this episode of the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. In this show, we cover a broad range of topics that cater to both commercial real estate newcomers and industry leaders alike. I'm your host, Giannis Papadakis, Business Development Manager at CREXI, and today we are thrilled to sit down with Aaron Strauss of A.Y. Strauss, Attorneys at Law. Before we dive in, a little bit about our guest. Aaron Y. Strauss is one of the leading legal advisors in the commercial real estate industry, having provided insight and guidance for billions worth of transactions during his career. As the firm's founder and managing partner, he has positioned A.Y. Strauss as one of the region's most respected law firms for commercial real estate owners, lenders, and sponsors. Aaron is responsible for establishing the firm's long-term strategy and vision, overseeing a culture of excellence and respect that recruits, retains, and supports a nationally recognized team of attorneys and business professionals. A dedicated dealmaker and connector, Aaron strives to identify and facilitate commercial real estate and other opportunities for clients and value contacts. In 2021, Aaron launched the Dealmaker's Edge with A.Y. Strauss podcast, highlighting the stories, successes, and struggles behind major commercial real estate investors. Prior to founding A.Y. Strauss, Aaron practiced for several years at an international law firm in New York. Aaron, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Giannis. It's a wonderful thing to be on with you today.
So when you first got into law, did you know that real estate was kind of what you wanted to focus on? Tell me a little bit about your career path and some of the lessons learned along the way.
Sure. I appreciate the question. I did always want to get involved in commercial real estate law. I thought it was a wonderful interplay between business, creative thinking, deal making, strategy. It just checked a lot of boxes for me. I didn't want to go into an area of practice that was esoteric or that I couldn't really see the value being provided and delivered. So I find it very exciting, frankly, to get the assist when our clients do a big deal or are successful, and anything we can do to build relationships along the way. As far as I'm concerned, it's just value created, and that's what I like to do.
Nice. And can you tell a little bit about kind of your pathway to law itself? Did you always know that you wanted to go into law?
Sure. Great question. I think most lawyers just sort of end up in it. There's no grand scheme. I didn't grow up as a kid thinking I'd want to be a lawyer. I always enjoyed creative thinking. I was a journalism major undergrad. I always enjoyed communication. I always was excited by commercial real estate generally. So I just thought law would be a really nice interplay and intersection of all those different skills that I had. I think in general, if you're doing career planning, you try to find that nuance, that balance where you could take the talent and skills that you may already have and the interest of where you want to be. And almost like a Venn diagram, you keep just creating the overlap as to where you can be maximizing your talents and your interests. And that's how I kind of landed on this.
Can you share some of the early lessons that maybe you learned, you know, at the beginning of your career that became invaluable later?
Sure, absolutely. Earlier in my career, when I worked at big firms around wonderful mentors and wonderfully talented attorneys, I got to obviously learn the technical aspects of running deals, which is invaluable. I think as far as training and career goes, if somebody has the opportunity to start their career at a larger institutional platform, it will pay dividends down the road, even if that's potentially where they may not want to stay long term. But I think that the technical training, number one, was fantastic. I'm thankful for that. I think also being exposed to as many professionals as you can, whether it's in a larger group or dealing with other firms or teams, you get to see things besides the technical aspect, but on the relationship management aspect, which you wouldn't often get if you were exposed to less people. So, for example, I had a mentor early in my career who always said, if you're involved in a deal, which is what we do for a living, stay in front of the client. stay in front of the deal. And what that means is be careful that no one's waiting for you because you're in the service business. So people are not only judging you for what they're going to spend and the technical delivery of that product, but if they feel like they're waiting around for something or you're too busy for them, even if it's just a quick ping, received, got it, reviewing, it means the world to people. So if you can engender an experience dealing with clients and professional services that they feel that you're right there with them and that every deal you touch or every engagement you take on, it's your number one engagement, and you can surround yourself with people who have the same philosophy, over time, you're going to be more successful than others.
Do you have any favorite mistakes or moments that maybe course corrected you onto your current path that maybe at the time you didn't recognize as opportunities?
It's a great question. I wish I could say there was one light bulb, one dynamic, but I think every lawyer who's been practicing for a while, every service professional that's been practicing for a while, has a whole litany of mistakes that they've made and frankly continue to make daily. And I think a lot of it comes down to selecting the people you work with to the extent possible. I think when people start out, whether they're starting a new firm or they're starting to work in a firm, you tend to group all deals and people and opportunities, interactions as sort of the same, but not every opportunity is created equally. Certain clients can be more difficult than others. And I think the sooner you realize that life is short and you want to surround yourself with people that respect your time, respect your value, that you can build a real relationship with that's not just purely based on, you know, how much was this, then that's where the meaningful, healthy, sustainable practice comes into bear.
And do you have any daily habits or practices that have become essential to your career? It can be commercial real estate related or otherwise.
Sure. I think philosophically, you want to focus on things that are important, not just urgent. I think when you're, you know, in any business that's requiring, you know, real-time communication, as I am, as you are, or anybody in the real estate business, it's a very fast-moving, fluid dynamic. You want to make sure that you're doing things today to, you know, keep those around you happy and pleased, whether they're clients, partners, vendors, whomever. But you're focused on your mental health constantly because you can't do this over a long period without getting your head in the right gear. But also you're trying to focus on what's important, not just what's urgent. So you're trying to do things today that in 2 to 3 to 5 years, you're happy that you did. So that famous quote, I think it was attributable to Jerry Rice, who said, do the things today that others won't, so tomorrow you can accomplish what others can't. I think about that a lot. And what that means is a lot of people won't make that investment to be relationship focused. They'll just say, all right, I have a deal. I'm working on it. I'm going home. Got paid today. It's a wonderful day. But you always have to assume that the world is moving and shifting in many ways. A client who may be doing deals this year may be doing none the next year. Or they may decide that for whatever reason, they want to go to some other firm. You need to be building your pipeline for relationships constantly and investing in those relationships, whether it's a hot market, a down market, a lukewarm market. And, you know, treat people the way you want to be treated, because that's the type of thing that builds a reputation, a brand for you personally, professionally, that has dividends to reward years down the road. And it's very easy to just take a very short-term near, you know, what's in front of me now, do it today attitude. But the greatest reward, whether you're in brokerage, whether you're in real estate law, whether you're in accounting, whether you're a real estate syndicator, it's going to come through relationships that have been engendered and created, and the value was invested in year over year, but broken down hour by hour over years.
I appreciate that. That's a great insight. And I think it applies to professionals, you know, in any arena. So I'd love to learn a little bit more about your entrepreneurial side and the founding of your law firm. You know, what's the story of A.Y. Strauss? You know, what were the primary factors that played into you striking out on
your own? Sure, great question. I was working at a very reputable, solid firm, which I really liked, for about 5.5 years, doing a lot of mid-market real estate transactions with a great group. It was 2010 when we started. I'd always want to start my own shop, being very entrepreneurial. I love business. I love the law as a business. I love the idea of the challenge, etc. But 2010 was a good point in that I felt like it was a real bottom. And in retrospect, it really was. 2008 was, I wouldn't even call it a bottom. I would call it a frozen tundra. You know, there was just nothing happened, no liquidity, no capital. But by 2010, I felt like there were enough conversations happening where there would be some market flow. And, you know, the market was so challenging for commercial real estate then that I had been shifted to doing certain things I didn't want to be doing, litigation and some other practice areas, just to fill the time. I mean, there were just no deals during that market. And so 2010 was kind of a crazy time to start. But during that period, I really was able to take advantage of the fact that the analogy I give is if you have a horrible tornado come to a town, or a sandstorm, a windstorm, a snowstorm, whatever, you wipe out all this infrastructure. When that clears, it's a new market. I mean, think about what's happening today. There's markets that are challenged, markets that are successful. A down market is a wonderful time to create new relationships because people have time to talk to you. They're all out scouting new opportunities. They're all looking under new rocks. So from 2010 and on, year over year, we built, we added people, we added clients. There's always some surprise. There's always a step back. There's always a step forward. But those early days were days that, in retrospect, I was blessed that it wasn't a crazy market because I was able to spend time thinking about what type of firm would I like to grow. It's amazing how much talent could be available in a down market. So I saw firms, for example, now that are very significant, very strong, very well regarded, true institutional firms during that time pick up a lot of talent that otherwise wouldn't be able to talk to them in a hot market. They'd be too busy working. So I was able to just take the approach, take the attitude of it's not going to be easy. And by the way, it never is. Whether you're in year 13 or year one, it's always difficult. But I was able to take the approach that, again, the more sort of difficulty I can endure in the short term, the better off it'll be long term. And again, making those longer range decisions on real-time dynamics has been my calling card to date.
Can you share, you know, what was your core principles in starting your company and how have they guided you over the years?
Sure, it's a great question. I think when I started, my core principle was stay open, stay open, stay open, no matter what happens. It was just fear every day. And like I said, the fear never goes away. It just becomes a little different. But as I grew and developed and hit any milestone, I really did learn in real time about the concept of culture and the concept of relating to people daily, whether clients, team members, vendors, whomever. And I learned almost by negative experience I had. So I used to think, well, you hire somebody who's brilliant, everything's going to be wonderful. Could be farther from the truth. You need to align yourself with people who have the same philosophy, who are service-oriented, who have a generosity of spirit. You want to provide compensation for people that's good, that's healthy, that's strong, so that they stay, not pay them just enough so that they don't leave. You want to reward people for great behaviors. And it took me a number of years of having experiences that were negative with different people to make me realize this is type of person perhaps that wouldn't be the right fit for what I'm trying to do here or wouldn't be the right client. So it's kind of a circuitous way of answering the question, but I really learned by forming opinions around negative experiences than starting from the beginning. Because I before this, I never ran my own firm before. So the first few years was really just scrambling and finding and fixing and tweaking, which never stops. But again, trying to find those people that share that philosophy with you. That's really everything.
And really kind of to piggyback on those first few years, you know, what challenges were you facing at the beginning and how did you overcome them?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first few years you're facing a lot of challenges, right? I mean, who's going to go work at the firm if there's nobody there but you? You know, who's going to be the first clients? Who's going to take a chance on a brand that never existed before? People may like you, but they want certainty of execution. So it's always safer perhaps to go to a larger platform. Challenge was the market was still extraordinarily slow in 2010. as it slowly crept up. Like I mentioned, finding talent, and then just cash flow was very, very much cash carry. And very hard to break that cycle of investing for the future, making payroll, getting ahead, saving, building. The other challenge we had initially as well was client concentration. We had a client that was a big client, which people think it's very exciting to get a big client, and it is very exciting. But as a business owner in the service side, whether you're law, accounting, brokerage, whatnot, you need to make sure you have a diversified pool of clients so that you're not wholly dependent. You don't accidentally become what they call a captive firm, where all your work is for this client. It feels as if you have a business, but in reality, you don't have a business, you have a job. And if that client leaves, you're in deep trouble. So we had a concentration with one big client and just made a point that it was riskier to stay that size than it was to grow. And thankfully we did grow because we did work with that client for many years, but ultimately we no longer work with them for a variety of reasons. It's fine, but thankfully we're able to continue to push growth throughout that year, throughout that multi-year process.
Do you have any favorite deals that your team's worked on that you'd be willing to share with our audience?
Sure. I wouldn't say there's one showcase deal. I mean, I could tell you this week we closed a deal, a $60 million multifamily deal in North Carolina, which is very exciting. We're working on it.
Congratulations.
Yeah, and multifamily deals are harder to come by these days. We're working on another multifamily deal in Ohio as of now, $40 million transaction. We're working on a ton of different leases, retail, some office, a lot of industrial. Working on a lot of industrial acquisitions all across the country. We have a lot of litigation cases. As you can imagine, the market is very, very challenging in many ways. So partners who didn't get their distribution, or maybe they're getting diluted, or perhaps, there's issues with the lender. I mean, right now we're dealing with a variety of forbearance agreements and restructuring loans for both lenders and borrowers. And, I like to think we're kind of like the way station of the market. We have traditional deals going forward, which I think hopefully will always be there. We have problems we're fixing or helping to fix from the past. And then as the market finds itself, finds its legs and decide what it wants to be doing, hopefully we'll just sort of morph along with it. But from when we started, all we can do was a basic real estate deal. I always knew that the down market would come again. And I always wanted to make sure we were structured to handle full cycle of a deal. So whether it's litigation, bankruptcy restructuring, foreclosure, joint venture, leasing, acquisition, sale, financing, construction. So trying to put the pieces together to imagine what that deal maker might need in the future. And I'm excited where we are today, but I'm also looking forward to trying to grow further.
Can you talk a little bit about how do you choose the clients that you work with?
Sure. Well, initially it wasn't very hard. If there was a client they want to work, no problem. And honestly, when you're having a down year, you're much less selective at times than if everything is super busy. But when it comes down to what we're really looking to do is find that mid-market client that's going to appreciate the value we bring, be able to wow them with great service, build that friendship with them that they know we're going to have their back, and try to really understand their business plan, what they're trying to do, and, try to be in a position where it doesn't really feel so much like work all the time. We get them, they get us, they know we'll rise to the occasion, they trust us. And I always tell clients, we don't want to deal with you once. We're trying to compete for deal three when we get deal one, because anybody can get a one-off transaction. If the client's not happy, they'll go somewhere else. Or even deal two, they may give you a shot. But deal three means that you've solidified yourself as a first-class organization that provided value over and over again, where that trust is started to be created. When you create that trust, then you're obviously focused on getting the deal done perfectly well and the costs under control. But it becomes more of a conversation versus, this distant attorney-client relationship.
You become part of the team.
Be great.
Can you share, from a legal perspective, what makes a good deal?
It's a great question. And I will say, from the law side, you don't nearly get to see the deal from the economic perspective as driven by the IRR and the way the partners have structured it and so on and so forth. And everybody has an Excel spreadsheet forecasting what the deal's going to do. And then most of that just ends up in the garbage and the deal's going to be what it's going to be because there's a lot of risk factors. But I will say the partnerships that I've seen be successful on deals are those that, again, you may negotiate the hell out of it because you got to protect your position, whether you're a co-GP, LP, institution, syndicator, it doesn't matter. But there's mutual respect created through both parties. Whether you're the passive investor, you're looking for that GP who's going to be a deal creator and engine. You're going to look that they're going to manage their portfolio exceptionally well. And you're going to look to relationships that no matter what an operating agreement says. And now, in real time, we're reviewing these joint venture agreements and these operating agreements that people signed years ago and didn't think twice about, but now they're super relevant for purposes of things like dilution and management and control and recapitalization. You're really getting into a marriage in many ways in these agreements. So you can have a 150-page operating agreement with somebody, but if you don't really trust that partner and you don't feel like they're going to be with you in good times and bad times, that's difficult. Because invariably you are riding shotgun with them, whether you're the passenger or the driver. And I think that mutual respect going into the deal drives it. A lot of luck, as much people, most people won't admit, but there's a ton of luck involved in every deal for that successful. But another thing that I think is a softer quality that I've seen people leverage successfully in deals, and I know this sounds a little bit strange, is just as far as raising money goes, a lot of it is just confidence. It's sitting down with the partners and sort of creating this vibe, if you will, that this is the sponsor that you trust. You sort of have the gleam in the eye, the fire in the belly. They understand the economics and the nuance, but this is the horse I want to bet on. And a lot of it's subtle, but the sponsors and investors I've seen create that confidence in the market, really, really fantastic.
And you're also the host of your own podcast, the Dealmaker's Edge with Aaron Strauss. Why start a podcast?
Yeah, it's funny. Usually I'm in your seat, so it's very intimidating to be the guest as opposed to the host. But all kidding aside, I love having conversations with people. I love talking to our clients. I love talking to people in the marketplace. And I'm always curious to get an education. So I learn through osmosis having these conversations. And I realized some of the contacts and relationships that I have, besides for being great marketing exposure, right? You can really co-market, co-brand, collaborate with some wonderful names, some of our household and some who people may not know. People like to tell their own story. So it creates a nicer relationship with your contact at the very least. But at the same time, I like to listen. I like to absorb. I like to read everything I can and listen to everyone I can to learn. So I figured if I'm going to enjoy the conversation, let's just get it out there. And I have found it to be fun. At times I'll scramble for guests because, you get really busy in deals and then you realize, my podcast is out in 2 weeks and you're clamoring. But I find for folks who are really busy, you want to get on their radar and, you want to build a relationship with them. You may already have a friendship with them. Maybe you did a deal, maybe not, whatever. It's a nice solidification of the relationship, and it forces the other party to really tell their story in a coherent way. It creates an emotional bond, and it also, parlays to the market that this person can be trusted. So when you have a great Rolodex of people and contacts have opened up to you, you become a safe person to transact with. And I think that credibility that it creates, the relationships that it could deepen, and the knowledge that you share. I mean, for example, if you're a lawyer, accountant, you're a professional services person, you're really selling knowledge, right? You're selling knowledge, maybe documents, maybe peace of mind, whatever it is you want to call it you're selling. But you're in the content business. So if you're creating great content that shows that you're going to create thought leadership that people care about, they want to associate with you and your brand and your contacts and your knowledge, it just puts you in the conversation. I think it's important for you to put yourself out there if you're a business owner. It's not my natural personality. I'm not naturally outgoing, even though I've sort of forced to become that way as a business owner. But it's a way for me to leverage my skill set, I think, as a pretty good listener. And also, I find that some very successful people like to share their stories and like to get that promotion. So it is really a win-win.
What are the most surprising things you've learned in creating educational content like a podcast? You know, is there anything that you had to overcome or were unexpectedly delighted by?
Sure. I think for people who may be listening to this who have been thinking about doing a podcast, one is I think everybody who jumps into some media creation always has imposter syndrome. And I face it every time I record with a guest. I always think, what am I doing recording with this guest? You know, and they're on the other side of the camera thinking, what am I doing as a guest with this podcaster? So I think you have to get over a little bit of imposter syndrome, which is very relevant. I've never done anything like this before. You get increasingly comfortable with mistake making. You tend to overfocus and overjudge yourself on technical attributes when you're first starting out. So you have to be open to the fact that things will not go perfect and you will say or ask questions that will not be perfect, but life is not perfect. Just embrace the fact that we're all imperfect. Just roll with it. Go ahead, make some mistakes. People aren't judging you as hard as you're judging yourself. And I've also been thrilled with the fact that we've really had some wonderful guests on that have really done a great job sharing their story, or to run into a friend of mine or get a message online through social media saying, I really appreciate that conversation with so-and-so. It really struck home to me, because you don't know what people are going to say that's going to impact others. So I love that facilitation aspect.
Excellent. Well, moving along to our third topic for today, you know, as an attorney who's overseen hundreds of deals, I'd love to know more about today's transaction landscape. You know, what does the negotiation table look like in deals being transacted today?
Sure. Well, I can tell you based on just literally what we're doing today. We are negotiating a large multifamily transaction, and you'd be surprised. In this market, still, people are being asked to do all their diligence up front, before signing a PSA. In a market like New York City, which has been, frankly, devastated for a variety of reasons over the last number of years, it is really, really the Wild West, and not in a good way. You know, so we're negotiating with a lot of lenders and borrowers and restructuring deals and whatnot. And like I said, more litigation and more bankruptcy claims and cases. But you are still seeing a lot of movement. You know, there's still a tremendous appetite for industrial product. I think, you know, people are, now that they're sensing where interest rates may stabilize or go, there's at least some sort of clarity around how to underwrite on a transaction. As some client told me the other day, obviously people feel like it's too late to sell and too early to buy. So nobody wants to catch that falling sword in this marketplace. So they're sorting out what they're going to do. You still have tons and tons of capital that needs to go places. But people are skittish to be out of the gate. Some people are using terms like negative leverage, which hasn't been said in a long time, which basically means buy something that doesn't make sense. So if you're a family office and you have a 10, 20 year horizon and you know this is a wonderful asset that's going to be in your family for 20 years, you really may not care, versus you're a fund manager and you're IRR driven and you can't go to your investment committee and make that deal pencil. So I think it's the type of market for deal making. Again, this is just secondarily based on conversations I'm having with clients and people in the market, is that for people who are proactive and aggressive and will take a little bit more risk than others, it's a wonderful market where a lot of people have pulled back and retracted. Big institutional partners and capital partners, investment committees, where a smart sponsor can come in, buy a deal. Again, it's scarier, just like it was scary to buy in the beginning of COVID, which people did successfully. But in a year, two or three, as things stabilize, and again, what stabilization means could mean a million things, so we'll put that aside. The appetite will return for institutional capital and for different private investors. And then when they're in a better market, they really get the benefit of the risk that they took in this market. And I think we've seen the last few years massive swings. I mean, just even think about it. 3 years ago, you had COVID, right? Or is it 2.5 years? I'm losing track of time. Where if you said you were in retail, that was a four-letter word. I mean, people would laugh at you. And then it became necessity retail was the darling. But now all of a sudden, well, no one wanted investment retail a few years ago. It's an incredible asset class because people are back and they're shopping and the consumer's remaining strong. So things obviously are in cycles. Assets become in and out of favor. Markets go in and out of favor. But I think as long as somebody has their eyes wide open and continues to look, I think also, you know, the people who will do deals in this market will get on the radars of the brokers and the people who will send them deal flow. So the people who wait too long and say, oh, I want to see this, I want to see this, guess what? They're not going to see much. And the people who put their neck out a little bit more will get the benefit of the deal flow. And invariably, you have to be doing deals to create and to see new deals. And I think there's a little bit of that mixed in too.
Right. How would you say buyers and sellers are navigating kind of the widened bid ask gap right now? Would you say that, you know, more sellers are kind of conceding and stepping down right now, or are you seeing buyers stepping up? Like what's been your experience?
That's a great question. And I literally just asked that to someone this morning who works at a, like an institution. And, the question I asked them, I said, are you seeing deals pencil better today than 6 months ago or 3 months ago? And I couldn't get a clear answer. You know, I think if you ask people who do real estate deals for a living and, you know, the broker side, the lawyers, the accountants, whoever it may be, transaction volume is way down for those obvious reasons. But that debt maturity has to create deal flow. You know, either these loans get restructured or they get recapped. Everybody wants to be in preferred equity where they, you know, bring fresh capital, you know, and then live to fight another day on the deal with some sort of upside to the original sponsor. And I think realistic sellers will be met by realistic buyers. It's just what realistic means. That's for the brokerage community and the appraisers to sort out in real time.
Have you noticed any trends recently in terms of negotiation, whether, you know, it is, you know, sellers conceding more or lender financing?
Yeah, I am seeing on the financing side that people still need to do financing transactions in their portfolio, and some that are proactively coming to the lender and saying, hey, my deal doesn't really pencil, but I'm going to bring fresh capital and I want you to extend, work with me. I'm seeing that happen successfully, you know, in real time. Occasionally you have somebody just go dark on a lender. That never ends well for them. You know, it's not like during the great financial crisis, if you're a homeowner and your house was underwater, you just sort of stop paying and they deal with you. This is commercial real estate with very sophisticated parties. I am not hearing lenders want to become asset managers. They typically never do. They want their borrowers in there working as hard as possible, but they very much do not want to sort of sully their books with bad loans either. So it's not quite extend and pretend like it was, and every deal is different. And again, I'm just seeing a small microcosm of what our clients are doing. But I think if there's proactive communication and there's a desire for respectful negotiation, people who want to sell will be able to. And people who buy, again, there's plenty of capital, plenty of financing available, just they're going to pay a premium. And also, I'm seeing on the recourse, non-recourse side, people are going to pay an extra premium for the non-recourse at times now, but just because how valuable that is given the uncertainty around the markets.
All right. How would you recommend players in the commercial real estate space stay most up to date with new trends or take advantage of new laws?
It's a great question. I don't really have sort of one suggestion, but I think it's just never stop learning, right? It's very easy to say, this is what I do. This is my asset class. These are my lenders. These are my investors. The most successful people I've found in real estate are always moving. They may have a long-term vision, long-term horizon, but you can never meet enough investors, right? The people with great investors, whether they're institutional or private investors, they always seem to do fantastic because they are able to have deal flow and confidently get that deal flow closed. So you always want to introduce more capital relationships. You always want to meet as many competitors as possible. It's a very open-minded community where obviously if two people are bidding for the same deal, they're not going to openly share some certain confidential information, but I find that people are very vocal about what they're doing, and they're happy to share, and they're happy to trade war stories, and they're happy to make introductions. And if you do a great job as a sponsor, or as a service professional, or as a broker, the word gets around pretty fast. So deal honorably, educate, constantly be moving. And again, the people I deal with, it's never enough deal flow for them and never enough capital relationships. And you always want to be pushing the growth every day. Some days, you know, maybe a market where it's really rough. This year is really rough for everybody. Maybe you only feel like you move an inch or a foot or a yard, whatever the metric is. But there'll be some months where you're galloping through an open field, taking miles. So, but again, as long as that forward motion is always happening with the end goal in mind, you will get there. It just may not be on the same scale of time that you'd want.
And with that, you know, what would you say are the most common pitfalls that you see, you know, commercial real estate stakeholders fall into? And how do you usually guide your clients through those obstacles?
Sure. I think sometimes if we're advising a large limited partner who's considering investing into a general partnership, it could be tough where if you're a syndicator, you're very fee driven, obviously. You want to make fees. You got to pay your analyst. You got to pay your rent. You got to pay your overhead. You get management fees, different asset management fees, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a very fine line between building long-term equity for your stakeholders and keeping your own lights on. So you want to respect the fact that every deal needs to get capitalized. Things like acquisition fees, of course, they're very normal. But you want to be wary that you're truly in the equity business. You're not in the fee business. I don't mean fee like as the legal title to real estate. I mean fee as far as earning fees as you go. So I think the best syndicators will, and the best sponsors, the best deal makers will really try very hard to walk that fine line. And the best investors will respect that. But the incentives really should be on the back end for those sponsors to earn their promotes, you know, the good old fashioned way.
Now, moving into next year, are there any trends that you're most excited about as we progress through 2024 and beyond? And, you know, that could be, you know, creative financing terms, you know, data supported transactions, thanks to new technologies. You know, what excites you in this sector as we move forward?
It's a great question. There's been a lot of talk about all these new technologies, whether it's AI. Everybody says they're in the AI business. And I think everybody is without knowing it, just because all the technology we all use is powered by some algorithms which we'll never understand. And for a while, I was losing my mind over that, in that I thought, you know, a computer, a robot's just going to take my job. I'm not going to add value. And I think everyone has that fear. And to some degree, I do believe law will have to get reshifted tremendously on its head for business model purposes. But beyond that, I do think one thing that will never go away is that emotional intelligence, you know, understanding truly what the human being across the table from you is looking for, and inspiring trust and being transparent and treating people well and listening. Those are things that really a computer cannot do. And deal making, there's a lot of nuts and bolts in it. You got to create documents, you got to create expectations, checklists, lenders, sponsors, investors, brokers. Everyone has their role in the deal and the transaction. But if you can create a reputation of somebody who's going to be the glue and bring everyone together, and again, whether it's an amazing broker who just finds a way to cut through those final negotiation points, or a lawyer who's a deal maker who's not going to be an obstructionist, those people will be rewarded over time. And there will always be technology that will be exciting for them at that time to use. But I couldn't point to one thing today that's super exciting. If anything, the more technologically savvy and advanced that we get as a society, I get more inspired that the softer skills actually ironically become more important.
Excellent. All right. Well, hey, given your specialized background and expertise, we'd love to ask a few rapid fire questions. Sure. That we do with all of our guests. Are you ready?
I'll try my best.
All right. Now, if you were giving $50 million today and had to invest it immediately, what would your go-to asset type and location be, and why?
Great question. I would say multifamily. even though now the market is disjointed and finding a transaction will be harder, I do like the sustainability of the asset class. It seems to me to be long-term, risk-adjusted, a great return. And then the two states where we have seen clients be super aggressive on have been Texas and Florida. Florida, obviously, insurance issues have come up. And Texas, there's issues in lots of pockets of it. But I think those two states, if you buy long-term multifamily, low-levered asset, good location, take care of the property, you'll do fine well over time.
Nice. Do you have a favorite or most recommended book for peers or young professionals?
I read the book Never Eat Alone when I was younger, and I really thought it was fantastic in that it's not technical, it's just stories. It's really a story book about building great business relationships. So it won't teach you anything about economics or finance or law or accounting, but again, it will hit to the human element, how to be present, how to make those critical investments in relationships, how to show up for people, how to become known as somebody who's going to be a giver. Those types of soft skills over time really, really will yield returns. It may not be immediate, but over the years, they'll create a return.
Never Eat Alone. I have to look at that one. Do you have a favorite tool or software that you use on the job?
I wouldn't say there's one. I keep a lot of lists. I don't have one specific software. There's a lot of lists. And, you know, I have a list for you know, clients we're on, you know, a deal list, pipeline management, people I'm talking to that I think I'll end up working with, operation lists. So there's no one great catch-all. I wish I did. I'd probably be, you know, way more successful if I could manage to put it into one bucket.
And then do you have... would you mind sharing, you know, what do you think is the most common misconception about your job or industry?
Sure. Common misconception. I think perhaps that there's almost like a fearfulness to get the lawyers involved. Sometimes they're, you know, clients may feel like, oh, the lawyer's going to get involved. They're going to kill the deal, or they're going to be obstructionist, or they're going to be difficult, or it's stuck in legal for weeks, or they're going to just be focused on every bit of minutia in the contract that it's going to be a problem. And I think there's definitely a lot of that in our industry, and there's a lot of waste, to be clear, there's a lot of waste. But again, it goes back to relationships. If they're authentic, if they're real, if they're substantive and they're vibrant, people know that you're not creating work to create the work. They can trust you, that you're there to protect them. But you also want to work with people that know when to say enough's enough. We got to get the thing signed. And that fine line is where you make a career, frankly, in my opinion.
All right. Well, as we wrap up, do you have any parting words you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, first of all, Giannis, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you and your audience. It's been a lot of fun. Hopefully I created some value for people, and would love for people to check out our podcast too, Dealmaker's Edge at A.Y. Strauss. And would love to see if any collaboration opportunities between our two podcasts as well. It'd be fun.
Absolutely. So thank you so much for joining us and sharing your insights. You know, I know you're very busy, and we appreciate you sitting down and, you know, spending the time with us. Where can people find you online if they want to get in touch? You can share, you know, email, social media, LinkedIn, and you can plug the podcast again, please.
Sure. No, I appreciate it again. I think the email is the easiest way, ays@aystrauss.com. And email me. I'm very responsive. Always happy to talk to anybody at any time, whether they're in the legal profession, whether in the brokerage business, whether they're a syndicator sponsor. Anything I could do to add value anytime to anybody is my highest and best use. So do not hesitate to reach out for anything. I'm happy to talk.